On the subject of dual validity in the ontology of intelligence assets, we can look briefly at Christopher Hitchens, who shared a plain, persuasive, emotive writing style with Orwell, and who wrote a book praising him. Of Orwell's list, Hitchens said it only contained names of those recognised as left-wing already, and that nothing that Orwell discussed with his old flame was ever used for a show trial or witch hunt. He just wanted to keep a clear accounting in the battle of ideas. This was echoed by the old flame Julia Kerwin, who said that the only bad thing that could happen to the people on the list was that they might not be asked to write for the IRD. Given the dating of Orwell's original notebook, its thoroughness and passion, and the fact that it contains names like Katharine Hepburn and Paul Robeson, whom Orwell thought hated white people despite his great championship of the British miners, one could see this as disingenuous on the part of both Kerwin and of Hitchens. Hitchens, of course, has long been a mystery to the left, which he at first professed to champion. I remember that when I was writing for Overland, the then editor Ian Sison expressed his puzzlement and frustration at Hitchens' unexpected support for the American invasion of Iraq to me, and said I couldn't. And I said I couldn't account for it either. I perhaps can now, though. Hitchens' second wife, the beautiful Carol Blue, whom he married in 1991, calling it love at first sight, came from a family which had worked for Lockheed Martin and Atomic International, and the experienced journalist John Helmer has written that her family was also part of the powerful General Atomics family of military contractors, drone developers and arms manufacturers. With Rupert Murdoch, Facebook, Microsoft, Google and the Pentagon, the General Atomics Blue family is a large donor to the militant think tank Center for a New American Security, which trained Victoria Nuland and others. Whilst there is no evidence as to whether or not Carol Blue supported her husband's enthusiasm for the second Bush invasion of Iraq, they had both opposed the first Bush war, and his support for other U.S. military occupations, there was perhaps for Hitchens a similar psychology to that of Orwell in embracing a passionate marriage as the way to balance great internal contradictions and to organize a transition from one pole to the other. Certainly, Blue's writings about Hitchens and his death have a poignancy and persuasiveness that smooths away any sharpness from posterity. All that might be wished to remain is the series of Annie Leibovitz's publicity photographs of Hitchens and Blue as a young couple entwined expressively and contentedly on a big floral couch the year before they married, making it almost impossible not to wish them well. Coincidentally, just after I wrote the above, Annie Leibovitz very recently did another couple photo shoot, this time for British Vogue. The couple, apparently in need of sympathetic publicity this time, were Vladimir Zelensky and his wife Elena. Whilst the photos used vintage Leibovitz romantic intertwinings and attracted quite a lot of derision from left-wing political commentators who photoshopped them with bundles of dollars and thought that the seminal image from the poster for the film Titanic was recognisable, we should take the photo shoot seriously here. In fact, without any political conclusion, we should note that the Western publicity campaign for Ukraine, and perhaps at the expense of its population, has been organised with increasing efficacy since Victoria Nuland's Maidan coup in 2014, and now employs several strands of sexual persuasion. At the refined pole of the campaign, akin to what we have seen Scribner's Maxwell Perkins describe as respectably sexy, designed to attract the feminine readers who control the destinies of so many novels, we have examples like the Leibovitz shoot, media replays of the television comedy Servant of the People, beginning in 2015, in which Zelensky plays a schoolteacher who accidentally turns into a disarming populist president, and many other suitably casual but reliably soulful photographs and videos. These perhaps involved a little too much reliance on one dark-toned shirt, with the inevitable remarks by commentators after the Leibovitz photos that his wife must indeed be devoted to him because he never seemed to change it. Again, we should examine this photographic method seriously, however, as it reflects a certain mechanical and perhaps overconfident, even contemptuous aspect of Western media publicity. British Vogue is a sister of American Vogue and, like it, owned by the Condé Nast firm, which also owns many other sophisticated publications like The New Yorker, Allure, with its Best of Beauty Awards, and the articulate social media forum Reddit, in all of which many readers feel secure in an erudite, humanitarian, sometimes sceptical, but always comfortable community. One of the keys to this is a selection of reliable personas, such as Hitchens, Leibovitz, and now perhaps the two Zelinskys. Sometimes another key is the providing of a themed visual background to enhance the characterization. This was pioneered by the genius of modern American fashion photography and portraiture, Louise Dahl Wolf, who from 1936 to 1958 was a staff fashion photographer at Harper's Bazaar, owned by Hearst since 1913. She developed a meticulous but seemingly spontaneous method of setting her subjects against erotic or informational backgrounds and concentrating on infusing dark colours into her pictures to give them more sublimity. At all times, she tried to convey the individuality of her subjects, including glamorously clad women and carefully presented nudes, and was a successful propagandist for the Roosevelt government's domestic campaigns during the Second World War. She sympathetically and beautifully photographed left-wing celebrities such as Orson Welles, Ed Murrow, and Josephine Baker. She was not in herself such a celebrity as is now the endearing Leibovitz, photographs of whom taking photographs tend to Google up even more often than photographs taken by Leibovitz herself. The essence of fashion photography, of course, is to create a sense of expensive but accessible and desirable sexuality, embodied by personae the viewer recognises and wishes to engage and emulate. When effective, it is characterized by the same sort of personal detail that distinguishes all intelligent erotica from pornography. In regard to the use of pornography as well as intelligent erotica in propaganda, the topic of Ukraine is again very important. It increasingly seems to me that two aspects of what first appeared to be negative publicity about Ukraine are in fact intentional propaganda for it, but designed perhaps to appeal to a different audience. The first is the ubiquity of the swastika symbol in photographs of Ukrainian battalions. The second is a routine video footage disseminated constantly on the internet of Ukrainians, deemed antisocial by Ukrainian vigilantes and officials, being tied to public street posts with plastic binding, then stripped, humiliated and flogged, including frail elderly men and struggling young women. There can be any stipulated cause for this, but one ostensible reason given by the perpetrators is that the victims are gypsies. Indeed, the rehabilitation of the Nazi collaborator Bandera as a national hero fits in with this as a manifestation of a genuine fascist ideology, but as well as that, it may be that both the swastika symbols and the flogging are an attempt to attract an SM audience, which the propagandists regard as just as large and powerful as are the followers of Condé Nast. Whilst many whose sexuality extends to SM may be as liberated and tolerant as Kenneth Tynan, there is no doubt that others are furtive and authoritarian and would gloat about such pornographic violence as that in the Ukrainian videos. The trend in these videos might be expected to become even more violent and pornographic, since Ukraine has extended its military conscription to younger and older age groups and to women, all of whom may be punished for resisting. More evidence that these videos are calculatingly pornographic is that the content is even more so daily, involving bloody wounds, bare buttocks, howling mouths and pretty young children being instructed in how to administer the whippings. On several occasions in general, I have been aware of power figures having a taste for SM and suggested to them that they might like to emulate Tynan and be open and discursive about it, but the response is usually one of recoil. Furtiveness is clearly an erotic requirement for them. Either that or there is an element of Ghislaine Maxwell and Jeffrey Epstein, and the furtiveness is necessary to create a secret world in which they can have power by their knowledge about others. Whilst one does not have to assume an organised cabal, such as is supposed to exist for pedophiles or Satanists, it is an uneasy concept that such propaganda may be calculated to influence and attract a particular section of the powerful, and that these powerful are sometimes the providers of a less extreme form of propaganda, such as that in publishing or fashion-style photography. Another interesting aspect of SM propaganda, such as this described, is that it is an inversion of expected propaganda, discussed earlier here, in which all the atrocities and sexual peculiarities are attributed to the opposition, although there is always a fair amount of that attribution as well. It should be stressed now that there is no suggestion that the suffering of those tied to street posts or their captors' enthusiasm for swastikas isn't real. The stylization is that of organization and presentation. Perhaps if one knew who supplies all those miles of plastic bondage, one might be closer to knowing who the stylists are. But there is doubt that their knowledge would embarrass them, although it might unnerve the self-interest of some of their followers.